Hello and welcome to this festive edition of What We Just Watched from TV Cream. I'm Graham.
And I'm Ian.
And in this Christmas episode, we're going to start with my choice of viewing. We're in the perennial situation where you will know instantly what the show is.
Okay.
So what I would be interested in are your thoughts about the slight Christmas tweaks for the opening titles.
Interesting. Okay.
And also of you, the kind of which specific Christmas episode this is going to be of this franchise.
Ah, right, okay. Already I'm beginning to turn things over in my mind.
Okay, well then before you turn much more, let's hit it and let's see what you make of this.
Well, it's Wogan, obviously, and it's the Wogan title sequence with a Christmas makeover, presents and baubles flying about the screen. Ah!
And what do you think is happening here? I'm going to actually pause it here because there will be a bleed into this special Christmas. What might it be?
I'm guessing then it's one of the Wogan Christmas special episodes.
Yes.
Because not only have we got the wintry title sequence, but you've had all those Christmas decorations. And he tended to do, for a time he did Christmas and New Year special editions. So I'm guessing we're going to see something a bit different to the usual weekly Wogan.
Okay.
Is he in a different place?
I'll play on a little bit more before we stop.
Or an unusual location, perhaps.
Okay, let's see. Oh! What can you see here?
It's Terry in a... Is it a Rolls Royce? Or a limousine?
It's a limousine. Driven.
Well, I know what it is. It's Terry. It's when he goes off to Denver to interview, in character, people from Dynasty.
It is. Okay, so we'll watch that episode as Terry's arriving, and then we shall report back on how Terry gets on in his tryst with the Carringtons. We've just watched the Wogan Christmas episode, which aired on Christmas Day, which was a Wednesday, in 1985. What time of the day do you think that went out?
I think this went out quite late, didn't it? Because BBC One had its various Christmas comedy specials and one-offs and so on. And so this Wogan would have been bumped from his usual early evening slot to quite late, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. It was 10 p.m, so it was after the two Ronnies and then before the Christmas film.
Well, that feels about right to me, because any earlier...
Do you think?
Then this would have been enough. Well, I don't think it's... Yeah, I wouldn't say this was primetime fare.
It's quite a damning assertion.
Well, to me, it's not your obvious Christmas Day schedule blockbuster. I think... Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yes. Well, but it is a blockbuster episode of Wogan, because... So the conceit is that he has gone to Denver to visit the Carringtons,
yes,
from Dynasty at home, although they don't get to shoot any of it apart from one sequence actually inside the Carringtons' house. So instead they have to go to La Mirage, which is Blake's kind of hotel complex within the show, which is a very bland and generic background.
It's incredibly anodyne, and it's got no atmosphere.
Yeah.
It's completely empty of everyone,
and it doesn't reek of Dynasty at all,
no,
does it?
It could be anywhere. It could be
a travelodge.
You said
or something.
It could be your just a roadside motel.
This is prime period Terry, and yes, from the point that when we first see him, his salutation to the viewers is a classic Terry line, isn't it?
Hello there, my little chickabiddies.
This was when he was at the peak of his powers, by which I mean his ubiquity across the BBC. And at the nation, across the nation at large, because he'd just, previous year he'd finished his Radio 2 show, he'd given it all up to concentrate just on
the
Wogan.
Telly. Yeah.
And we were at the end of the first, pretty much the first full year of Wogan on BBC One. And this was still the point in the history of that programme when it was considered such the prize in the BBC's crown, the crown jewel of BBC One, that... the show had to be on,
yes,
every Monday, Wednesday and Friday, regardless of what else was going on those days.
Almost as if there would be some kind of panic in the streets if Wogan wasn't on.
Well, it was akin to the Ravens leaving the Tower of
London. Yes.
Had Wogan not appeared on one of those
the
days.
Or the shipping forecast on the radio.
Yes, yeah. And you tuned in and it wasn't there. What's happened? Has the bomb gone off? is at the end. And hence, because Christmas Day was on a Wednesday this year, Wogan had to be on.
And is it fair to say that one of the kind of parts of his sort of regular pattern was always that he would attach himself to normally a US show. I mean, Dallas is the classic.
Got the old hankies? Ready to have your emotions thrashed? Your finer feelings pummeled? Your fondest preconceptions dashed? You'll never be ready at the same time for the final episode of the present series of You Know What?
And then he would obsess about it, but also always take the mickey out of it. That's kind of... do you think he considered that was part of his...
That's his shtick, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he started doing that on the radio to Breakfast Show with Dallas.
Yeah, was it initially about the poison dwarf, wasn't it? Charlie Tilton's character, yeah.
And all the stuff about the hair never moving when the wind blows.
Yeah.
And having walk-in wardrobes and all of this. And he kind of... It's partly responsible for, I think, for popularising Dallas in the early 80s and the whole JR stuff. And
do you think then when Michael Grade was considering buying Dynasty, part of his rationale was thinking, actually, Terry,
yes, that's
this
it,
is going to be manna for Terry. Let's get that in. And it's kind of can rejuvenate his...
Or else maybe also when Grade was pitching this the new chat show to work, it's going to be great, Terry, because you're going to have a chance to not only talk about the people, but you get them on. Because they shipped them all over throughout 1985.
In Is It Me, Wogan's autobiography, which I would recommend, would you? I think it's a good book. Yeah,
he writes through it in about a day.
Yeah, but it is funny.
Yeah.
He writes about Dynasty, and he says, Dynasty, though heaven knows silly enough, never had quite the charm, the enchanting utter foolishness that made Dallas so wonderfully watchable. So it's quite funny that there is this sense, and maybe it comes across in the show as well, that he feels... slightly diminishing returns with the material that he's having to riff
upon.
That's
interesting. Yes, I suspect that he's probably a bit proprietorial towards Dallas because he feels, oh, I was there from the start.
Yeah.
And now here comes Dynasty, which is it's not cut from quite the same cloth, but it's obviously trying to replicate that same mix of the outrageous and the glamorous.
Mm. And Terry makes a little allusion to that at the end of this episode, doesn't he? When we have a scene of him walking down the staircase in the Carrington's house.
Watch your step, lest you tumble over and lose your baby.
First to JR.
Precisely, yes. Point, there's a painting on the wall.
Look at this. An ancestral Carrington. Stop me, vitals. If it isn't old JR Carrington, the man who invented the shoulder pads.
That's interesting.
That's
yes.
a little bit inappropriate, isn't it? When he's there at the goodwill of Dynasty.
As he's been invited as a guest by the Carringtons.
I hope I find you well this Christmas evening and that Christmas Day has gone wonderfully well for you. The BBC, in their wisdom, have sent me as far away as possible from you on this Christmas evening to spend it with a very fine family who live in this imposing old pile that you see behind me.
The concept is wafer thin.
It's wafer thin because Terry is arriving to interview the Carringtons in character, except for when that conceit then breaks and they're kind of not. I mean, when we're looking at it, we were trying to piece together the rationale here because, for example, we have John Forsythe and Linda Evans, Blake and Crystal, and they're appearing in their night attire.
And how very informal you are on this Christmas evening. La Mirage in your night clothes.
We have John James, who plays Jeff, who looks not in costume at all. And so we have this kind of mixture of personalities... Some who are in certain costumes, some who aren't. And the idea is probably that he's coming on a day where there's maybe a photo shoot going on or they're doing some scenes. And then he's told, OK, you can have these cast for 20 minutes.
Yes.
But you're going to have to just get them as they are and work around
it
that.
It feels very much like that, yes. And whoever is available, he's had to work with them, which I suppose is why you get this slightly sort of... rather loose, ragged feel to it, where he's just in this one location, one set.
Yes.
And you can almost imagine the production manager saying, shoving so-and-so on.
Exactly.
To
and right, clearly they're shooting in the house, which is why he can't shoot in the house himself. So
oh,
clearly
yes.
we're using the house today, but you can have the La Mirage
set.
Yeah.
And there's even a bit where, I wondered if they were hoping to get someone and they couldn't, where Terry has to fill for a bit, which is he's wandering behind the bar.
Yes, and just picking up props and things, yeah.
Look at this. Taffy Christmas decorations in the most expensive club in Denver. And the bottles? They must be drinking like fishes. Every one of them's empty.
And the whole thing also is a kind of, I don't want to use the word testament because I'm not sure it's an endorsement of, but it's a lot of it is about Terry's famous attitude of doing no prep and just rolling in and just having a chat. And yes. I'm not sure he pulls it off in every instance.
I think the problem is that because it's the same setup over and over again, he encounters a member of the cast and they indulge in a bit of spontaneous chit-chat. Because we see that 6, 7, 8 times in a row, by the time you get to the fourth one, the novelty is worn off.
I mean, also in each of them, he gives a gift as well, which is a Wogan T-shirt or a mug.
Yes. Again and again and again. And again, the joke, it's the mug again. It's funny 2 or 3 times, but then you get to the seventh time.
And I like it that he, this is typical Wogan, that he has to fastidiously, when he gives it the first time to, well, should we call them by their character names?
Yes.
Blake and Crystal.
Blake, yes.
It's from himself, but also...
Particularly from the DG of the BBC.
The DG.
Of course, as if they would know who that was.
Yes, and his own soap opera is kind of crossing over
That's
into their soap opera.
Yes.
It begins with Terry arriving at the house, and they clearly have to conspire a reason why they're not shooting at the house, because as a viewer, you think, well, you know, why isn't he in the character's house?
Ah, good evening. My name's Terry Wogan. I've been invited here by Mr. Blake Carrington to spend Christmas evening with him and his family.
I'm sorry, sir. There's no one here this evening.
But where are they?
They're all at La Mirage.
Oh, La Mirage. Thank you.
That then leads to a scene with John Forsythe and Linda Evans, where they're clearly being told, can you improvise some Blake and Crystal chat?
Oh, it's nice to be here. Away from everything, pretty lady.
Do you like Blake calling Crystal pretty lady?
Well, there's a lot of that in this programme. There's a lot of very mid-80s and now incredibly outdated and ill-advised repartee.
We did tell everybody, didn't we, that we were coming here?
Oh, yeah, we told everyone.
Oh, I see. Now, wait a minute. What about the Irishman? What about Wogan?
John Forsythe, for example, had been on Wogan the previous summer. And you know, if you go and have a look, there are photos on Rex Features, for example, of Terry and John Forsythe at Ascot Races together.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And one actually senses there is a proper rapport
That's
between those two people.
Yes.
And my memory is, and alas, I can't get a hold of the episode, is that in that appearance, that's one where John Forsythe, during the chat, made Terry kind of push his hair back to reveal to the audience he has these enormous ears. There's a back reference to that, isn't there, in this chat when John Forsythe talks about Terry's lobes.
Yes.
I'm jealous of your long ears, you dirty devil.
Good sign in a man. I think we already established that. Big lobes, a very good sign. Women find them pretty irresistible.
Well, don't say.
The setup with Wogan is always that he is slightly hangdog or crestfallen.
This is important, yes. He plays this character of... It's a version of Terry Wogan, isn't it? It's
yes.
Terry Wogan in inverted commas.
To be honest, it's a bit quieter than I thought it was going to be at Christmas night. You know, after you inviting me and all for Christmas.
Yes, well, I tell you the truth. We came here because we were trying to escape you. I mean,
nothing personal.
I mean, you're
our friend. You couldn't say anything more personal, though.
No one wants to see him.
He's the Brit abroad.
Yes.
He's already been... He can't get into the mansion.
Yes.
So he's had to slink off to the...
To La Mirage.
To La Mirage.
But he's very good, isn't he, at kind of the self-deprecating mining those
He
moments.
Has got that act down to a fine art by this point. And he can turn off that crestfallen look in an instant.
Yes.
And it always works. Because it always diffuses any awkwardness in the situation, because it immediately puts him in the role of the put upon.
It does. Well, he's deferring the status to the interviewee.
That's it. Yes. He knows his place.
But does that? Do you think he feels it gives him license to be? Some of his questions are quite rude, aren't they?
He is
and quite disparaging.
Listen, do you ever get sick of the character Crystal? I mean, she's so good.
A lot of his questions are based around, well, this old shit that you're in, or... I think the other thing that that exemplifies, for example, John Forsythe's connection with Wogan is he hones in on Wogan's lovely fat knees.
Well, I would think now, having basked in the Southern California sun, those lovely fat knees would be tan and beautiful.
What would you think, though, if you were watching that at the time? Why would, I mean, would you have thought, that's quite an endearing thing to say?
Yes, I would, yeah.
And what, someone remarking on Terry's fat knees?
Yes, but then also it's one of those things, it's part of the Wogan canon that you know, every encounter is underlined by this tension about, are they going to talk about his knees? When are they going to mention his knees?
Is anything about his appearance?
Well, but his knees was the Wogan totem, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
The knee touching. And so one needs to get there. It's a kind of...
It's a need to know.
It's a need, yes. And then he then reciprocates with his kind of stock in trade coming about, which is the shoulder pads.
The old shoulder pads. You even wear the shoulder pads in bed?
Yes.
You do, don't you?
You don't wear yours?
That's all she wears.
Oh, no, I don't sleep in a dinner jacket, for goodness sake.
That's all she wears is just shoulder pad. It's all she wears is just the
in
shoulder
bed,
pad.
Just
nothing
shoulder
else.
Pads.
Two shoulder pads.
She looks like an American footballer.
I don't want to be here anymore. I'm going
to
leave.
No, don't go, for goodness sake. I've only just arrived. I've come all this way.
Oh, he loved them. That's his go-to reference point, isn't
did
it?
Did he curate that? Did he find that reference?
I think
that's
so.
Where it came from Terry. He spotted it.
Either him or Clive James, because both of them were sort of instrumental in both raising awareness of Dallas and Dynasty, but also highlighting the absurdities of it.
So you find me in the presence of royalty. Your mother would be so proud. Now, the last time we saw you, if I may call you such, Princess Amanda of Malvavia, the last time we saw you, you were sprawled all over the place, looking very dead.
After speaking to Blake and Crystal, he then meets Amanda, which is actress Catherine Oxenberg. Now, actually, this one, the conceit dissolves pretty quickly, and one gets the impression all she's been told is, Terry's going to come in and talk to you. Can you just, you know, and we're going to need you back on set in 20 minutes.
There is an element of... And here is where we run into our problem, which is the sequencing of this programme in the context of the Dynasty story as a whole, because I think you were saying that this programme was broadcast in Britain.
Yeah.
Just after the start of Series 6.
Yes, of Dynasty.
Now, remind me, the storyline, the cliffhanger at the end of Series 5 was the wedding massacre.
Yes, the Moldavian massacre.
Blessed is the kingdom, the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Now and ever, let us pray in peace.
I think an urban myth is that the producers had staged this event because they wanted to renegotiate everyone's contracts. So everyone ostensibly could or could not be dead.
The final shot was of everyone lying in a big pool of blood on the floor.
And which was a terrific cliffhanger. However, looking at this, it was resolved very quickly in the UK because it looks like Dynasty then rolled
straight on into the
pretty
next
much
series.
Into the next series.
Okay.
Certainly, the first episode of Series 6 aired on December the 20th. So by the point that Wogan's episode aired on Christmas Day, we would have seen
who lived and who didn't, which is basically everyone more or less survived.
Everyone of note, pretty much.
Yes.
So you're kind of marrying beneath yourself, really, as a daughter of Alexis.
Yes, but I think that Amanda's probably very impressed by titles.
And there is a weird thing with Catherine Oxenberg where initially she refers to her character Amanda in the third person before sort of twigging that actually she is, and then it kind of comes up. I mean, Russell Harty was clear on this, wasn't he? There was a clear, when he met the cast of Upstairs Downstairs, he made a clear demarcation when if the question was addressed to the character or the actor.
That's true, actually.
Silver, yes, Bellamy was self-made. Are we talking about Bellamy or David Langton? Me?
I think let's talk a bit about David Langton, since you've overwhelmed me with your Bellamy.
That if you're looking for precedence for this sort of thing, a British TV personality visits the set of a serial or soap opera, then I suppose that Harty programme...
He created this genre,
He broke the mould.
Stepping into this fictional world. I mean, if you could have dispatched Terry to an... I mean, El Dorado would have been the obvious.
Well, yes, because then you could have had a programme called Tel Dorado.
But alas, that could never be.
sadly.
I mean, Terry venturing into the TARDIS with the Doctor. Yes. And the Doctor could have then delivered him to locations to interview Davros. And he could have interviewed the Master.
Yes. Where are you? You, Master.
Avast thee, yes. Ye blackguard.
Yes. Get your hands off Doctor Who.
I got the impression that Terry doesn't have much of an empathy with, not necessarily Catherine Oxenbow, but certainly the character Amanda, and his questions become quite generic and vague about plot.
Yes. Can you tell us any more about the plot? What's going to happen? Is it going to be appalling and death and more tragedy and blood and guts everywhere? Or...
Doesn't this crescendo into...
It becomes quite unsavoury. You know?
Yes, because he's at one point... she says incest...
Really?
Oh, yes.
This is terrific stuff. This is the kind of stuff we want to hear.
Incest?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
You're talking the kind of language I want to hear on Christmas night.
Has Terry lost control of the interview?
Well, I wonder whether it was this, these kinds of exchanges which led in part to the backlash that this programme encouraged, which I'm sure we will talk about later.
We will, yeah.
Because... This is one of a number of occasions where the mood is quite misjudged, or it comes over as being a bit, what are we meant? Is this meant to be jovial? Is it meant to be a bit more gritty?
But also there's nothing substantive being said either, is there?
They're just flicking out words at each other.
Yes, and we haven't learnt anything. And it's kind of the worst, it's the worst type of repartee, which is... It has this. It almost has the rhythm of being humorous without having the content of humour. Well. In fact, without having any content.
Vodka gimlet, please.
I'm not a new waiter here.
You're not a waiter?
I've been invited by Blake Carrington for Christmas.
His next encounter is with John James, who plays Jeff Colby, which I felt that was a much more laid-back...
He managed to deal with Wogan far more competently.
Yes.
But it's interesting that he was in it, because... this, again, ties in with what was going on the screen,
yeah.
Because... the Colbys had started this year.
Yes. Terry does make a reference to, why aren't you in California? But he also...
Yes.
He also... Yeah, well, if one could criticise Wogan, and we are slightly, he does belabour certain things, so he does make a crack about Fallon... changing face.
I mean, did you find it difficult to adjust to a new woman? I mean, I know it was Fallon, but she seemed, to me anyway, to look just a little bit different when she came back.
Now, that's something that actually has been established, and that's happened a little while ago, and he does it again when he's talking
into
to
his
Stephen.
Store of,
yes, it's a slightly
hoary
old and I think
references.
But I think the thing that I like in particular is that he presents John James with a T-shirt.
It's a Wogan T-shirt.
A Wogan T-shirt?
You'll find of the very, very finest hemp.
But the actor is more excited at the fact that there is also a pen and a keychain.
And a pen.
Oh, this is a pen.
Don't break the pen.
A keychain?
And a keychain, yeah. It's pretty lavish, isn't it? Yeah.
I think that I was disappointed with the T-shirt, just as a side point, because it's a plain white T-shirt,
yes,
with the Wogan logo on it, but the logo is tiny.
And it's placed above the left nipple.
Yes.
Kind of the size of a Fred Perry logo.
Have thought that you would have a massive Wogan logo, like almost like a sash,
yes,
going across the whole front, yes, of the T-shirt. Maybe even Terry's face somewhere on the T-shirt.
And then, what about a Terry Wogan on tour T-shirt, but then every day to Shepherd's Bush Green?
That was, yes, and they're all Monday, Wednesdays, yes, and Fridays. That's, you see, oh, God.
Terry on tour T-shirt.
Yes.
Wogan on the front, Terry on tour. And you all, while we're talking about the merchandise, the mug, you were intrigued by...
Because it doesn't look like a proper mug. It's not your... sort of bog standard mug, which is quite a sort of a squat thing, isn't it? This is quite a tall and elongated mug with a curled lip around the top.
Do you think it's for filter coffee? Is that...
Ah.
It's a kind of... It's a.
It's not meant for tea, you mean? It's more of a morning mug.
It's, well, I was thinking more in the green room before they come on and they have a sophisticated... Or yes. Maybe an Irish coffee.
Well, I was going to say, might it be conceived with a bit of alcohol in, yes, mind? Slip it into the... into the mug before they go on.
This is turning into a very profitable conversation because we've got the Terry on Tour t-shirt now, but now we've talked about the Terry Wogan Irish coffee mug.
They missed another trick there.
That would be great. The next encounter is Terry comes in and meets Gordon Thompson, who plays Adam, Michael Praed, who plays Prince Michael of Moldavia, and Michael Nader, who is my favourite character, Dexter. It's a great name. I didn't like this encounter.
This is the most shambolic encounter because there's too many voices.
The people were stopping each other in the streets of Britain to talk about your bravery during that massacre.
Really?
Really? How can you do that? God. You were hiding behind the skirts
You're
of
damn right. Yes, of my mother. Were. I have more sense.
Talking over each other, Terry is never sure who to look at, and the three of them, I don't think they're actually, they're not very interesting people anyway.
I felt they're a little hostile. Well,
I
want to expand on that, but first, I want to just rewind a little, because I've introduced them, but the way Terry introduces them.
Adam Carrington, Prince Michael of Moldavia, and Dex Dexter, a.k.a. Gordon Thompson, Michael Praed, and Michael Nader.
He imbues these kind of mechanics with a lot of charm and character, doesn't he? Just with an inflection, a pause, a kind of...
He was always very good at that. He
builds the drama.
He was always good at doing those kind of... The sort of the furniture of the interview.
Yeah.
He treated very much as if it were the... just as important as the actual substance.
And our feeling, again, we looked at this and we're thinking, well, why are they here today? Michael Praed, we think, is in costume. He's wearing these kind of striped trousers.
He looks very odd. It's not the sort of thing, even for a show in America, it's not your casual wear.
Gordon Thompson is potentially dressed as Adam, but I thought Michael Nader looked like he was in his civvies.
Civvies, yep.
So it's a very strange setup. And I think it's one of these... It's a testament that sometimes in an interview situation, you don't want to be talking to someone who's there with their peers because they begin to get self-conscious because they're in front of their pals at work. And so instead of engaging with you in a proper way, you just start being silly.
Just one question. Where in heaven's name is Moldavia?
This is true. You go to Odessa and hang a Louis. It's true. It's true.
They fool about, don't they? That's the default response.
And they kind of ends up that they're all egging each other on.
Yeah, it's the least effective bit. And it ends with... they chuck a load of...
Well, but no, before that...
Oh, sorry,
Michael, Dex Dexter, presents Terry with a gift.
Oh, that's right.
Now, please respond to that. Describe the gift and respond to that.
Well, it's wrapped up in a box, in a sort of anonymous box.
I think this is something you might enjoy here, you know, in...
Terry opens it up, and then it turns out to be an enormous sausage.
It's like a bratwurst.
It is.
Oh! It's just a little...
Oh, no, Terry, please...
Hunting the wheat already.
And he bites into it straight away.
What's the joke? Is it supposed to be bawdy? Why is he giving Terry a sausage?
Does he think that it's a British people like sausages? Is it really that obvious?
A Brit abroad is thinking now. Really good to be here, but where do you do your sausages?
Where might one purchase a decent bit of sausage meat?
Then, yes, as you say, it felt as if Terry had wrapped the thing up, but then they say, actually, before you go, and then...
Would you be so kind as to accept a small token of our...
But this is too much, I've already had.
Each of them produces what they claim is going to be another present, but it turns out to be a bag of snow, or like fake snow, and throws it at Terry, which gives Terry another chance to do his hangdog thing.
Because that's the only thing that rescue is that this happens.
They really chuck at him with some force.
They really. But then it cuts to a kind of reaction shot of Terry.
Ho, ho, ho.
Possibly done after they've left the room.
Ah, maybe.
But it's Terry again, hangdog.
Sitting there, completely motionless. Looking very undignified, covered in all this white
stuff.
He was
always happy to be undignified.
Absolutely.
Wasn't he? I think he knew, in the same way that Arthur Lowe used to make sure that his glasses became askance in a scene on Dad's Army, because he knew that was... Terry is always aware there's a lot of comedy, isn't there?
And that provokes... That will evoke warmth from the audience.
Yes.
There he is, Terry. Taking one for the Brits again.
Is there... Do you think what he is doing is... Because he speaks in this kind of... a very florid way. Is his humour in between Is he someone who's slightly trying to be grand and pompous and is a failure? Is that where his gag is?
That's interesting, because he's not...
Because he's Lord Terence of Wogonshire.
Yes. I mean, in... he's not a natural comic. He's not a funny person. He has all these devices which he uses to give him an air of comic charm.
Yes.
Because he doesn't... I mean, doesn't he's not... He can't tell one-liners. He doesn't do routines.
No.
I don't think he is a funny person. He's not like Bob... You know, you think about someone like Bob Monkhouse next to Terry Wogan. Mm. I mean, you couldn't... They're poles apart in terms of the way they use comedy.
Mm. His next encounter is with Pamela Bellwood, who played Claudia. She is outside for some reason.
Yeah. So she's got a baby with her.
She has a baby. Maybe what's happening during that production down Dynasty is that she's arrived and she's bought the sodding baby. And the production, like, well, we don't want that crying in the background when we're shooting loud. Next door.
Yes.
So she is outside. And again, we're not sure what footing we're on in terms of the fictionality and the factuality, because Terry is talking to her about... He talks to her about the practical problems of being pregnant on the set of Dynasty and how they covered
that. Well, that's interesting.
How did you manage to work the pregnancy into Dynasty?
We didn't work it in. Yeah. We shot around it, so I got a lot of close-ups. We were behind desks and we were in looser garments a lot.
But then he follows up by asking who the father of her baby is.
I didn't get where I am today by not asking the obvious question. Whose child is that? Adams? Stevens?
Child of God.
As if it could be one of the fictional fathers.
On the programme.
Which seems an incredibly crass question to ask a mother with her newborn child.
Because it's implying that she might be a bit, she has loose morals.
Yes.
Oh, she could be having a way with anyone on this programme. And also, it's quite offensive to the baby's real father.
Yes.
Who maybe might be watching or just maybe there on set as well.
As I live and breathe. I think I recognise that back. Let's see if the front matches. By cracky, it does. Kate O'Mara.
Terry Wogan, I thought I recognised that voice.
It's me, yes. What are you doing here?
The next encounter is with Kate O'Mara, and there's quite a few interesting things about this, isn't there? Which is that she hasn't appeared on British screens yet in her role.
And also because, obviously, it is a familiar British face.
Yes.
And Terry's...
He cuts straight
relationship
to...
with her is very different.
This is a bit of a change from Triangle, isn't it?
It's about as different as you can get.
All that trolling back and forth between Felixstowe, Amsterdam and Göteborg.
That's right. It's a wonderful experience that was on the North Sea, yes.
He immediately goes to Triangle, doesn't he, for chat.
Yes,
talk about Triangle.
And of all the things to be reminded of... Just when she's on the cusp of appearing in Dynasty... The shit that was Triangle is the least.
It's almost as if that she's got this plum new job, and then, oh God, the guy I went to school with has suddenly showed up to say
like
actually
that,
all my
yes.
Qualifications are bogus.
Yes.
And he suddenly, because then she starts going through her own CV herself.
Brothers.
That was all right, wasn't it?
Well, yes, terrific. And Main Chance, isn't that one?
Yes, yes. Don't forget Doctor Who. I mean, I seem to work a great deal for the BBC.
She sounds quite desperate there.
Should be here. Done some Doctor Who. And then he asks her if the money is... Well, he makes a gag about the money being worse in Hollywood, where, of course, what he wants to get to is, God, you're
minted must be wrecking
now, aren't
him
you?
Now, yeah.
I suppose when you come over here, you find that you have to take a bit of a drop in salary.
I suppose that's one way of putting it, yes. Yeah. Not exactly.
I was disappointed because I thought that this would be an opportunity for some fine, sort of some rather more relaxed repartee.
Yes.
Because you'd expect that the two of them might have known each other or would have met before.
Yes.
But instead, there's quite a cool atmosphere between them.
But the papers said that you didn't like it much out here.
Yeah, well, the papers say anything. I mean, you mustn't believe what you read in the papers.
She's wearing a green dress, which is Caress's costume. And the interesting thing here is that is the dress that appears in... the publicity photos that were issued for her.
Okay.
And she was in those publicity photos. She's with Christopher Casanova and Joan Collins. Now, Joan Collins' absence.
Where is Joan? We haven't mentioned this.
Is a thing that haunts Wogan, would haunt Wogan for years. And he even makes a catty, or he tries to twist one of Kate Amara's remarks into a catty slur against Joan, doesn't he?
Now, about the character of Caress, she's Alexis's sister.
That's
right. Is she as nasty as Alexis, or even worse?
No, you couldn't be worse, could you? She's,
Was that a personal slur against Joan Collins?
No, a compliment on her acting.
So what's going on then? Why is Joan Collins not there?
Well, there's some bad blood, I think.
Between her and Terry?
Apparently so, because she was often announced as a guest on Wogan, or would be a guest, but then would cancel at short notice.
Really?
Now, Ian, I think this is very poor etiquette, but that same night that Terry was doing this
Christmas
special,
night?
Yes, Joan did appear on a chat show, but it was with Des O'Connor on ITV that very same night.
Treachery.
Ladies and gentlemen, Des O'Connor.
Now then, my next guest is probably the most written about and talked about, with a possible exception of Princess Diana, the most talked about lady in the world today. It is, of course, Joan Collins, ladies and gentlemen.
And what else could she be talking about but Dynasty?
How much of Joan Collins is there and how much of Alexis is there now?
Well, it's like any time that you play a role, you have got to bring into the role a lot of your own characteristics.
Of course. Oh, my word.
His next encounter is the one that feels very unfortunate. He's talking to Jack Coleman, who played Stephen. Now, again, I think I've alluded to this, that he begins, you know, he makes gags about the fact that Stephen used to be played by another actor.
Stephen, I remember looking slightly different than you do.
And Terry has this kind of slightly prurient, but I think that the difficulty is a slightly disdainful issue with the character's bisexuality.
He found it hard to come to terms with what can only be described as your sexuality, didn't he?
I find that hard to come to terms.
Find it hard to come to terms.
It's very tactless. I'm surprised that Wogan was not more sure-footed in this section.
Do you get any funny looks in the street?
And he really wants to drill down into the how do people respond to you when they see you. And initially Jack Coleman takes this as, how do people respond to me as, you know, I'm a famous character from Dynasty.
But it's funny, usually people just kind of respond to the fact that, you know, he's on television. They don't really, it's almost...
And yes, Terry just cuts into that. No, he wants to know, you know, but you're gay. You seem like gay. And
doesn't he say something like...
You're slightly cheerful. You're cheerful in the...
That's an interesting little euphemism.
Yeah.
It's such a strange use of words. It's like tiptoeing around the subject, but it's being neither one thing or the other. It just ends up being the worst of both worlds.
And also, what does Terry want to hear as an anecdote anyway? Does he want Jack Coleman to say either, well, yes, I've suffered lots of homophobic abuse, or is Terry even wanting to hear that of men coming on to? I mean, where does Terry want this to go?
Oh dear, it's not his finest hour.
However, at his lowest point, he's then back at his highest point.
Yes, it is followed straight up by...
Here we are, at the old piano lounge.
Oh, how are you?
He meets Diane Carroll, who plays Dominic Devereaux. Initially, there's a little bit of problem where, because he comes in and as he is doing, he refers to her as Dominique, and she corrects him.
Dominique. Diane.
Yes,
good
well,
to see you. Because this is your club, isn't it? Where else would you be?
Not realising this is the conceit.
She's not been briefed.
One of Terry's gifts are he has these... It's self-mythologising, but he has a panoply of lines to describe himself, doesn't he?
It's kind of a repertoire, which he has... I don't know whether he's amassed it himself or he's kind of accrued it, which he keeps stored away to drop into conversation at key moments.
And this one is one that I'm wondering if it was freshly minted for this occasion, but I feel it's up there with the best he ever came up with.
I've heard that you have a wonderful voice and that you love to sing Christmas songs.
Well, I'm known as the friendly fellow with the mellow bellow.
Is that right?
That's me.
Thoughts on that, Ian? That's everything, isn't it?
Well, that is one of the... the high points of this programme, I'd say, this and the sequence that follows, because we're back into very safe territory now,
yes,
aren't we?
Yeah.
We're away from all of the unpleasantness of the previous interview.
Dashing through the snow
on a one-horse open sleigh.
And I sense also that Wogan feels, oh, thank goodness I'm back into it. I feel at ease in this arena.
What's in it? Bells on bobtail ring.
Ding dong!
There's going to be some shtick going on, a bit of performance. And
actually, let me interrupt. Do you think it works well then? Because although Diane Carroll hasn't been briefed on the Dominic Diane continuum, she has been briefed. Terry's going to come in, you're going to do a couple of lines of chat, and then this song together.
Yes.
And it just makes everyone feel at ease. Everyone knows where this is going, don't they?
Yes, there's some structure to it. And yeah, they've got an end point they want to get to,
yeah,
and they know how to get to it, and so everything just unfolds.
Oh, what fun it is to ride on a one-horse open sleigh.
Weren't we just awful?
He then checks back in with John Forsythe for a final kind of capping off.
Merry Christmas, Terry!
One got the impression there's a real kind of genuine conviviality.
I think between those two there is, yes.
And perhaps when Wogan arrived on set that day, they made a beeline for each other.
You'd like to think that would have happened, yes. Oh, yes. He was the first person.
Here comes trouble, says John, as the door opens. There's Terry.
Yes.
John Forsythe, as I live
as
and
I
breathe.
Live.
And the final scene has Terry, so they've been able to negotiate 2 minutes on the set of the Carrington Mansion so he can do this walk down the stairs.
That's all, but that's all you've got. 90 seconds and you're out.
But how does Terry cap it at the very end?
He can't resist. It's not quite a pratfall, no, but it's a sort of it's as if he just slipped on a banana skin. He's about to go out through this enormous grand door,
yep,
and he does a little comedy slip.
And then he's outside, about to go home. And I always like the fact that TV of this era feels that it needs to show how people arriving at a location and then leaving at a location. You can't start at the location because viewers all think, well, how's Terry there?
What's he doing there?
It started with him in a car, yes, and he's going to pop off.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed Christmas with the Carringtons as much as I have. I've got to get lickety-split to Denver Airport and back to be with you on Friday live at 7. Enjoy the rest of Christmas evening and Boxing Day. See you Friday, 7 o'clock.
But because the Wogan wheel must ever be turning,
indeed,
he has to do the business of, well, I'll see you again on Friday,
yes,
live at 7.
Even in the middle of all this splendour, he has to do a bit of continuity, a bit of promotional stuff. But again, reminding you that no rest for Wogan this Christmas.
No.
He's working right through him and Father Christmas.
A slight coda to Terry's dynasty story, which was that it became a kind of a breach by which one of his enemies at the BBC was able to enter Terry's domain, which
indeed
was Sir Robin Day. Now, why don't you set the scene initially, because this is where Robin Day was starting to be quite outspoken about Terry's wage, for a start.
Yes, there was a big hoo-ha in the new year of 1986 because a newspaper had spoken to Robin Day at a party, a BBC party, I think, or some sort of social event, in which, perhaps lubricated a little by alcohol, Robin had mouthed off about various things, one of which was this programme, which he'd seen on Christmas night.
Yeah.
And he thought, he said something like, I thought it was the worst thing I've ever seen. It was such a waste of money. Terry jetting off the other side of the world while the rest of us were working as normal. And this was like given a full tabloid expose splash. You know.
So it's the start of a feud. Now, on the 9th of January...
Of 86,
an episode of Question Time. This isn't a hugely significant thing, but it's more interesting that Robin gets in a superfluous sideways Terry remark.
I should say that the reason that Bob Geldof could not receive an award in this honours list was because he is not a British citizen.
Well, Eamon Andrews got an award.
Terry
Wogan and probably got an award too.
There's no need, is there? And, no, but the audience clearly know.
Oh, they know. And it's clearly been weighing on Robin's mind, and he's been going over this and over this and over this. Because for some reason, he's got a real bee in his bonnet about Wogan and this programme in particular.
On the 20th of January, then Michael Gray thought it was a good idea to have Sir Robin come on, and he and Terry...
bring the two face to face.
Alas, I can't get hold of that episode. But that's not what one wants to see on Wogan anyway, is it? It's not a programme about confrontations.
And from what I've read, and there's a transcript of part of that interview in one of the books about Terry, not his own, but someone else's, it's not a very edifying exchange.
Mm.
And there's a sense of the two of them trying to outsmart each other,
mm.
neither of them succeeding. No. And like, you could imagine watching it thinking, what's this all about? Why? I don't want to see these two BBC faces.
Yeah.
Having a pop at each other.
No, we want it. We it's nicer to think that everyone gets on.
Absolutely.
But also, one doesn't want to ever see Wogan on the offensive. His style.
On the defensive.
His style.
Offensive.
Of what? Well, because he's having either.
Oh, do
either.
You mean actually try and
be assertive,
take the fight to a guest?
Yeah, because yeah. his style most of the time appears to be on the back foot, but he's in control. That's how Wogan works. He's the kind of, I'm the poor sap. He really is yeah. running everything,
yeah.
but that's how that's Wogan at his best, isn't it? However, we've got the next day's episode of Wogan. Well, not the next day's.
The next show after the day.
Yeah.
Oh, is there a back reference?
There is a little back reference.
You know, if all the stuff and nonsense written about me in this programme over the last couple of weeks was placed end to end, it would stretch right round Sir Robin Day's head.
Do you think that's a little beneath Terry, that little joke?
Well, did you hear how the audience reacted? Mm. They were surprised that he was going this stooping so low.
It's a little demeaning, do you think?
He's a bit below him. He should have just maybe moved on and let what happened, let bygones be bygones. He can rise above it. Doesn't need to keep harking on about Robin. Let Robin be Robin.
I mean, one thinks about it, really... Terry has his name in massive letters flying over London.
I know.
What more does he need?
It's true. He doesn't need to pick fights.
His big Wogan spaceship.
Yes, that's true. Coming into land.
So he should just let... Like Robin wants to do that,
domain.
Absolutely fine.
Yes, I've got my name flying over London. What have you got, Sir Robin? Well, we've just spent Christmas night with Terry and the Carringtons in
yes.
Denver, Colorado. Now it's my turn to surprise Graham with a Christmas programme.
Okay.
And Graham, not only is this programme immediately obvious from the sound
yes.
of the signature tune, it's you'll get it even from the very first image, the very first slide that you see.
Okay.
So there's going to be no mystery to this whatsoever. Here we go.
Oh, okay, EastEnders. Wow. Is it going to be the Den and Angie Christmas?
It isn't.
Good.
But?
I'm pleased with that.
When do you think this might be?
Well, it's...
Titles look quite grotty, don't
they? Well, it's certainly very early. It's definitely, and it's 4x3, and it's the old fade-up of EastEnders. I'm going to guess 86 or 7. Ah, is it Arthur's Christmas Breakdown?
No, it is in fact 85. It's the very first EastEnders Christmas, which is actually the day after Terry and the Carringtons.
Okay, well, we better watch it.
Okay, we've just watched, to all intents and purposes, the Christmas episode of EastEnders from 1985. I say that because it wasn't actually shown on Christmas Day.
No, nor set on Christmas Day.
No, it's set on Boxing Day, which is when it was shown. And this gives the episode its main structural device, which is a lot of characters talking about what happened on Christmas Day
mm.
and reflecting on that and sharing experiences and so on.
Did you have a nice Christmas?
Yeah, it was all right, did you?
Oh, yes, lovely. Mind you, someone talked me into a glass of sherry and I was up all night with terrible pains.
Why, don't it agree with you?
How important is it for EastEnders that the day, or at least at this time in its life, that the day it airs is the day it's set? Because I sort of think, I know that at this point we weren't getting soaps on Christmas Day anyway, but it seems a strange choice that why don't they put it out on Boxing Day but have it set on Christmas Day? Would that have been a problem?
I think they will want it to just be faithful to the calendar, and I suppose at the time the impetus was very much on gritty reality,
yeah,
and telling it as it is and not no pretense. But also I think this does give it that rather neat device of having characters refer back to what has happened off screen,
mm,
giving them a chance to talk about it. And as we see in this episode, there's a running motif, which is that Peter's done something,
yes,
on Christmas Day,
yeah,
during the gathering at the Fowler's.
Did get a bit out of hand, didn't it?
Well, I just hope you're going to apologise to everyone.
Eh?
For what you did.
For what I did?
Yeah.
What did I do?
Can't you remember?
Huh?
Well, if you can't, I'm certainly not going to tell you.
Which we never see, and in fact is never revealed to us.
Yes.
That's it. It's perhaps it's quite a hackneyed device, maybe, but it gives the whole episode a nice coherency, I think, anyway. And then at the end...
Shoot your feet out! Is that it again?
No, is that what?
Oh, Greg!
He's in drink again, doing it and again. He's doing whatever the...
yeah.
The
and again, we don't see it.
All we know is it's probably something lewd and rude.
This is a measure of how comparatively low-key this episode is, certainly compared with other Christmases, that is really the main through line of
well,
the episode.
Well, there's two other through lines, isn't there, which is there's Den trying to offload turkey sandwiches.
This place will be jumping tonight when people want to get their hands on these.
And the gag that whenever they appear, they've been discounted again.
They've been reduced in price.
Sorry, Den, but there's a bloke out there that's just holding a radio and it don't work.
And but the
again,
radios.
Very, but both, yes, and the fact that...
Den has offloaded a job lot of
cheap, knackered old radios.
Which everyone's given as presents on yeah. Christmas Day, and now at Boxing Day they're all returning them.
But think about that then. We've got a storyline involving Pete doing something no one knows, we never see.
Yeah.
Someone trying to offload turkey sandwiches.
Yes.
And a job lot of knackered radios.
Yeah.
And that is essentially all that happens in this
it
episode.
It is, yeah, pretty
think
much.
About that compared with only just 12 months later.
Yeah.
This, my sweet... is a letter from my solicitor telling you that your husband has filed a petition for divorce. Happy Christmas, eh?
And also Arthur Fowler has a breakdown in the very same episode.
Yes.
On the same day.
This is the last moment in EastEnders history then when it could give us a kind of a charming, nice Christmas Day, which didn't need to have a kind of
an
undertone of tragedy as well.
I think so, yes. Because even though... in later years, the show, again, would not appear on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it wasn't until 1992 that it would appear on Christmas Day, regardless of what day of the week it was, even a Saturday.
Yeah.
Even up to then, it was still sticking to its normal schedules. Even after, by that point, the show had already become elevated itself into sort of an operatic tragedy and drama. Here, we haven't yet completed the first 12 months of its...
no
existence.
No.
And so this is its first Christmas.
Yeah.
It's not even on Christmas Day. And so what we are treated to, which I think is the right word, because it is a bit of a treat, because it's there's nothing really bad that happens, is a sort of, we go on a kind of a tour around all of the main characters.
Yeah.
Almost all of them. We don't see Michelle, but
no.
Everyone else pops up. Just to sort of fill us in about what they've been doing and to reflect on what they did the day before.
Yeah.
Usually in the form of a dialogue with
yes.
someone else.
Yeah.
There's a whole sequence of characters.
There's a lot of debriefing going on, isn't there?
And it's one thing that struck me was that this did mean that you do have to see, I suppose this is the bane of soap operas actually all the time, characters who would otherwise have nothing whatsoever to do with each other, having to talk to each other to swap that those bits of information.
I just don't know what to say to her, Paul. She hasn't spent any of it, has she?
No, not that we know of. I mean, what would you do if your Michelle was nicking off you?
I think Angie and...
Pauline,
I think, is the most obvious example, I think. But I was never really that convinced by their relationship anyway.
No, it never felt like... One could understand Pauline and Den, or she refers to him as Dennis.
Yes.
Because I think that was supposed to be a sort of a schoolyard friendship. And so they've known each... And so she's the one who knows the real Den. She was always the one that could
she
kind
was
of...
always
could
the,
cut
the
through
measure of
everything,
him,
yes, and intimidate him. But so, yeah, I agree. With her and Angie, there seems to be no
And they're sitting
ground.
There sharing, having a bit of beer.
Yeah. Angie's sort of flighty, highly strung, glamorous... And Pauline is dowdy, downbeat in mood,
yes.
Very pedestrian kind of a person. It seems a very strange friendship, I think.
Aside from the fact that those plot lines in the episode are quite light and frothy, There's very little here that requires you to have any extra knowledge about what's been going on in the programme in the previous week.
No, actually, there is the only thing that you would perhaps need some foreknowledge of is another storyline, which is Saeed leaving.
I want to find out who my own person is. You never know, it might not be such a bad lad. But I'm not going to have any more pressure from family again. OK, I'm going to Bangladesh, but I'm going on my own terms. And if I don't like what I find there, then I am not staying.
Well,
or do you think it's enough think is there that we know he's leaving in disgrace?
Well, it's done so heavily, so heavy-handedly in this episode.
Yeah.
That, OK, he's leaving. He's done various... It's made clear he's disgraced himself in some way.
Yeah.
I was going to become a solicitor or a doctor, wasn't I? Only I couldn't get the qualifications. I failed. I was going to make a go of the shop. I was going to make a go of our marriage. I failed. Look, it's just a long list of failures. No wonder I transferred all my feelings of failure into something else. Sex.
It's his character's final episode. So yeah. He's been handed a kind of a valedictory scene.
He has
redemption. He's allowed to redeem himself in the eyes of his peers, because there's that scene when Lou kind of gives him a very symbolic farewell.
Remember, you're part of us, and we never turn our back on our own.
It's a typical Lou phrase, isn't
it? Yeah, so this kind of... I hated Lou as a character.
Why?
I always hated Lou.
Why?
Because she was full of that kind of shit, that sort of... these kind of salt-of-the-earth pronouncements.
Why do you say it's a load of shit?
Because one never believed that
she meant
any of those things, and she was always superfluously angry.
You can keep your peace, Offering.
Look, Mum.
There'll be no peace between us till you see sense.
She was always coming in raging. Most of her scenes arrive where she's like, oh, what's going on here? Oh,
just a thing would infuriate
so
her.
So as soon as actually she is quite jolly in a lot of this episode, and so that's quite nice. But most of the time, when she kind of... She arrives in a scene.
She would come in already.
Yes, annoyed and stopping the fun or whatever's going on.
I can see that.
And sort of telling it like it is. She's the person
who. Character, though, wasn't it? She was the matriarchal battle axe.
But if she was, you know, she's the person in Big Brother House who says, you know, I speak as I find. And, you know, it's that kind of. I can't bear those kind of.
Well, talking of characters you can't bear, I don't think you were particularly warm to Saeed.
No, he's so wet.
Neymar.
No, both of them are so wet, and it really feels like there is no conviction from the production in either of those characters. And it's so low key that the kind of sending him off, there's no drama in whatever happens. We don't even see him actually leave.
Nope.
But the other problem is that Saeed is a sex pest. That's his story, is that he's been seeing prostitutes making dirty calls to Debs. One doesn't really feel that one wants to see redemption for him. One kind of wants him to be packed off.
Now, you see, I hadn't remembered all of those things when I first watched this, which is why I thought, oh, he's going, he's obviously moving on to a new life. And that to me was kind of self-contained. But reminding me of all those other things does make me now view his whole farewell in a very kind of offhand way. It's like, oh, God, we've had enough of this character now.
Yeah.
Let's just be shot of him.
And it's sort
and
of like
wipe the slate clean for the new year when we can get stuck into this and that. Because I remember reading all this stuff about how Julia Smith and Tony Holland, they've plotted out months and months and months of storylines, and even years worth of storylines. They were going to introduce Michelle's pregnancy 6 months in to ensure that at this point, and then she would not get married and all this, and Den and Angie were there. So it's odd that... It smacks me that something has gone on.
Yes.
Maybe they weren't as happy with the actors or
something. Every soap has those quotes.
Yes.
In Brookside, they were going to kill Harry Cross and then at the end of the first year, and then they realised that he was such a great actor, his wife died instead. So I think that's the walk and weft of soap, isn't it?
Yes.
There's a little bit of that that goes on.
What about the whole sort of the pace of this episode? It begins with almost about a minute of silence.
Yeah.
With
the aftermath of Christmas, isn't it? Yeah.
With Pete and Kath.
Yeah.
Waking up at the Fowler's house where they've obviously spent the night. waking up incredibly slowly.
Yes.
Not saying anything. Pete falls off onto the floor. And then we cut to Lou sitting in a bed. And then we cut back to... And it's just, oh my goodness. It's just like, there's no concern about opening with a bang, is there?
No, not at all.
It's such a gradual... And even then, for the rest of the episode... Not really until the final 5 minutes when they're all in the Vic and then they're all back at the Fowlers. Is there any sense of much?
Well, I think
much sort of energy there
at this time in its life, these early days. I think there's an element in EastEnders where it sort of fancied itself as play for today a little bit, and I think they felt, oh, this is going to be a gem of an episode whereby we open so quietly and we'll have all these storylines kind of simmering, and because all the characters, all that happens is, as you say. They spend the time in the episode. It's a progression of a day, isn't it?
Yes.
Dotted in their locations around the square, talking about their storylines. Then they all converge in the Vic to still separately talk about their storylines.
It's a textbook episode, actually, isn't it?
And then they all go to the Fowler's house to have a final chat about their storylines. Yes. And then it finishes.
And then it ends. Yes.
But with this kind of new storyline suddenly arrive in Cassie.
Well, that's the one bit of the episode where you do need to have known something about what's gone on previously.
Yeah.
Where Tony and Kelvin are back at their
listening
house,
to Christopher,
listening to Spaceman Came Travelling. As you had to do in every programme around this time.
A knock at the door.
Oh, who could it be?
And you don't see them opening the door. The camera stays on the face of the person in the sitting
Tony,
room.
Tony, yeah.
Because you want to see them, oh, who could it be? And their expression. Oh,
Kelvin's been a while at the door. Yes. Who's at the door?
Kelvin?
And then only when that character returns... Kelvin. With this other person, is it made clear?
You wouldn't listen. Look at her. You wouldn't listen.
He says, oh, Cassie. But you needed to have known, I suppose, that, oh, it's his daughter.
And she's been beaten up.
And it so looks
clearly
like she's been bruised.
There's some decision that Tony made which has led to her.
Yeah, but that's the only... I think that's the only thing in this episode which... requires you to have been watching beforehand. Otherwise, I mean, it's almost the sort of thing where it's been designed as if, oh, you know, on Boxing Day tends to be when people have their families. Guests,
everyone's
going to
be half watching,
and it might be most people probably might not be. They only have half an eye on television. They might not remember what's going on. Let's give them something which can just be on in the background.
It's sort of almost like this. This episode of EastEnders is playing the role that Krista Burr's song is playing in the Carpenter's house, and it's kind of it'll be
on. It's atmosphere.
On. Yeah.
It's a bit of atmosphere in the background.
There, yeah. But then, you know, the last bit. It will grab the attention. Oh, Cassie, what's happened to Cassie?
And that one, people will, oh, goodness, of course.
Yes.
Well, then what about her?
Yes.
And then that sets it up for the following week's episodes.
I think there is a thing that EastEnders has always, always tried to do and has never been able to do. And someone once said, I can't remember who it was, someone who worked on the show, that the humour of EastEnders is the piss take. And they can't, this kind of ribbing of each other.
Oh, okay.
Whereas Coronation Street humour is the sort of quirky eccentricities, and it's sort of a gentler and it's a more observed view of life and odd characters and coming out with. Whereas in EastEnders, it's the sort of the characters
setting
each other
up.
Yeah, and banter, the horrible B word.
Oh, dear.
And I feel they've never been able to do that.
Well, was there some of that in this episode? I suppose that they were kind of ribbing Pete about what he did or what he supposedly did when drunk.
Yes, and there's the thing, for example, where Lou is about to enter the room at the Fowlers and Kathy says...
I've known that voice in one.
I actually quite like, because, you know, that is now an allusion, isn't it, to name that tune, which wouldn't
That's
work.
True.
But, you know, this kind
That's
of...
That's right, actually, yeah, which would have been on at the time.
Yeah.
Was on at the time.
But it's this kind of, oh, here she comes.
And you can imagine people actually saying that in real life.
Perhaps.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now, what about Den?
Also,
go on.
Sorry, another thing I like was when Den is talking about the sandwiches. Do you remember how he describes how well they're going to smell?
Oh, he says
these will go faster than Steve Cram. These will.
Well, that's what you always want.
I love
a nice topical reference.
Yeah.
On the subject of Den.
Yes.
What about Den and Angie at this point in the show's history? They seem to be quite reconciled here.
Yeah.
Or at least tolerating
working
each other.
Working together.
Well, what's that?
I found it in one of Sharon's drawers. I was putting away some Christmas presents and there it was.
How much is there?
I don't know, I haven't counted it yet, but at least 200 quid.
Oh, the thieving little cow.
We don't know that yet.
It's nice, in a way, to think about what we know is about to happen in EastEnders over the next 12 months. Mm. It's like, ooh, it's all everything's kind of, you can see now, it's all been set as if, right, we're going to have a period where the characters are kind of getting on and are almost quite boring in the way they're interacting. But you can imagine the producer thinking, just you wait, we know what's going to come. Just, we're going to deliberately simmer things down so that just in a few weeks' time, because Jan appears, she walks into the pub. Isn't there a famous episode?
In 86.
Early in 86.
Face to face at last. What's your name again? Jan, innit?
Yes.
Short for Janet, is it?
Yes.
And what exactly do you do, Janet? I never did find out.
I'm in personnel.
Oh. Sorting out people's problems, you mean? That sort of thing?
Yes.
Good, because there's a few problems need sorting out here and there.
Which then begins the whole chain of events that spirals out throughout the whole of 86.
Well, then Angie pretending she's terminally ill. That's
oh,
what
yeah,
happens,
and
yeah.
It all becomes... And leading up to that great, famous Christmas of 86.
What I like about the relationship is, and I mean, it pains me to say it, but Leslie Grantham's brilliant in the role.
He is good, yeah.
He's really good in the role.
It's so natural.
Yeah.
Having a good time? Hey?
Yes, I am. Great. Hey,
you've had a fair share of the old gig of water night.
Yes, I've had one of them.
Your style, is it?
Well, I thought it's Christmas, so I'm going to spread my wings.
What, wings as in birth? And spread it.
And Anita Dobson.
Yes, on your bike, Jenny.
She's brilliant in the role as well.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There's this
great
thing, I think the thing that works with her character is she's the sort of, she's kind of the life and soul, but she really plays this sort of, she's just keeping on top of her nerves.
Look, Sharon, when I took your dad's car, I was wrong. I know that now. We all make mistakes. That's why I've got to get it sorted out.
You can see that everything's, she knows things are about to unwind, and she's just on top of those, that all the time.
And there's a lovely moment also when, this relates to the plotline involving the dodgy radios. When one after another, these radios are brought back into the Vic, and there's a very, it's actually very well edited. There's a very quick scene where a group of about 7 or 8 people suddenly produce the radios.
Yes,
and then they quickly we move on.
Yes,
we don't need to linger on it. The point's been made.
Yes,
and then a nice bit of visual humour later still
with Ali,
where Ali hands Den the faulty radio back to Den, and he said, "Oh, I think I've got another one just down here."
Oh, you're in luck. Just got one left.
Oh, great! Jeez.
And quite clearly, just brings up the same radio again.
That's when EastEnders is good, when it can throw its humour away, and I think most of the time it was quite laboured, the humour in EastEnders.
Yes, so you're right. When it's slightly sort of offhand throwaway humour, not integral to the plot essentially, but just done. Oh, there we go, and then we move on.
Yes.
Those are the things that actually stick in your mind, I think.
Oh, something I also think. The show did get right and is maybe quite indicative of EastEnders is the way the characters refer to each other from time to time, in that certain characters use certain names for certain other characters. So we've mentioned that Pauline always calls Den Dennis.
Perhaps you and Dennis might be a bit to blame.
Angie is Ange to Den.
Oh, come off it, Ange. Where's she got nearly 200 quid from?
Sharon is
Princess.
That has the real verisimilitude, doesn't it, of real life.
Exactly,
yes. That's, you know, certain people. And it has a real lived-in feel, doesn't it? I wonder if that probably did come from the writing, particularly as the show hadn't been around
absolutely.
For that long.
Absolutely. Well, it's Tony Holland's style, that is, of being very down-to-earth. And talking of lived-in, the sets, oh my goodness, they are so tatty and dirty.
Yes, but in a good way.
Oh, absolutely, definitely.
Yeah.
I've never seen such a grotty...
It's a horrid place to find yourself.
It's absolutely horrible. But I think, that is so, to me, that is the real standout element of EastEnders during its early years, which is just how filthy it looked.
And everything is small as well, which is
also
true.
I always thought the Fowler's house
is
so tiny.
It's very boxed in everywhere. It's very claustrophobic.
Their living room is so small.
And I think because of that, the shots are also feel quite small because they're really close. Because you can't, they struggle to get 3 people in a scene in those environments, but it really works for them.
Yes, and it always gives the Vic a sense of real of people being packed in there as well.
And then this idea that you have this space in the Vic, which is the rear of the bar on the foot of the stairs. And
that's a traditional meeting point, isn't it?
Isn't it?
So many conversations would happen at the foot of those stairs.
And there's a real vocabulary with that. When we got our first shot there, you kind of think, oh, great, we're here now, because this is where stuff gets done, isn't it? When you're in that location.
And it's a great place as well for those conversations to be interrupted by either people upstairs or back in the bar.
Yeah.
So it's very,
it's
very
like
well,
a thoroughfare, isn't it?
Yes,
almost?
It's incredibly well put together. That's just the idea of having that one place.
Yeah.
Now, we have become used to EastEnders being one of the most watched programmes on television at Christmas.
Yes.
It doesn't top the ratings like it, anymore. I mean, yeah. It used to be number one
yes.
week in, week out. Thanks to a bit of ratings fiddling, a bit of shenanigans that went on in terms of adding together the
omnibus.
Yes. Yeah. This year, EastEnders was not the most watched programme in Christmas week. That honour went to the two Ronnies.
But now, in the first of a new series, a stocking full of spectacles, which are part and parcel of those disproportionate frames, the two Ronnies.
Oh, OK, on
yes,
Christmas night before,
exactly,
before Wogan.
Yes. So I wonder if, had EastEnders been on Christmas Day, I wonder if that, maybe it wouldn't have made any difference. Perhaps, cumulatively, the force or the momentum of EastEnders had yet to reach its critical mass. Mm. And as we know, 12 months later, it did top the ratings, albeit not as... not the 30 million, which is often cited.
Which, again, is an amalgam.
It's an amalgamation of both all the episodes that week, plus the omnibus.
Yeah.
But even if you strip them away, it topped the ratings in 86. But no, in 85, it was the two Ronnies.
Can I ask, did you like that episode of EastEnders?
Yeah, I thought it was quite a likeable episode. The time passed fairly quickly. I mean, I think with EastEnders, you can watch it in a kind of casual way, which is what I kind of did with that episode, and enjoy it just for what it is.
Yeah.
And obviously it has the curiosity value for being the first Christmas episode. And yeah. Quite an old, and all those old faces. It's always nice to see that. I think as time went on, you would have to take a position with EastEnders. You either were enough of a fan to invest in it completely, and therefore you absorbed everything about it, and you would be disappointed if there was not some big tragedy or a big event at Christmas, or you started to kind of detach yourself from it and think, oh no, it's just over the top, it's not what it used to be.
Mm.
We haven't reached either of those points yet because we're far too early in its history. Mm. So I think it's possible to just enjoy it for what it is, which I did. Did you?
So I found that quite affable, quite a pleasant place to be. But nowadays, for example, if I'm in my kitchen doing my dishes and EastEnders comes on,
switch it off.
Yeah, I will come through it and switch it off because I find it unbearable. Anyone can fall in love. What was the best of those two episodes we've watched for Christmas, Ian?
As the perfect Christmas viewing experience.
I think neither are a perfect, are they?
No. That itself is interesting. Neither is. So
the same year we picked, yes.
Yes, and they're on consecutive nights.
Yeah.
The lesser of two evils.
Well, I would say the...
the least worst?
Well, Wogan, unfair. I think...
Would you put Wogan above EastEnders?
I would. Wogan, it's slipshod. There's not a huge amount of thought gone into it. It's opportunistic. However, Terry's always charming.
Carries it, do you think?
John Forsyth, the rapport he has with that is charming. The song,
I don't know that. I can't get over the fact that the Carringtons thing is just so thrown together, and it's like, oh, will this do? Whereas EastEnders, I could see the craft that's gone into it.
It is a crafted episode. That's very true.
So I think I would have to go with that. I think.
Okay, so we're agreeing to differ. We're like the two sides of the
Christmas
World War One
gold coin.
Well, I was thinking more Germans and the
In Pipes of Peace.
However, we've come together to play football, and now we're retreating
just momentarily.
But Ian, I've got your wife's picture in my pocket.
Well,
still.
That's something that we'll always have to treasure forever.
You've been listening to the Christmas episode of What We Just Watched from TV Cream, in which we watched Wogan, Christmas with the Carringtons, which aired on Christmas Day in 1985.
And the episode of EastEnders that aired on Boxing Day, 1985.
Merry Christmas.
And a Happy New Year.